stop for a minute and think about some things. I'm Imal Lori, and welcome to the second episode of What the Hell is Going On? In our last episode, we talked a lot about the introduction to us asking the question and what we're going to address in these episodes. Because it's such a big question, we could go into so many different areas. But what we're really talking about and concerned about is our human condition, our experiences as human beings, and what it is that interferes with this one goal that we all have, which is a lasting, stable happiness. So I think that's where we need to start. If we're going to have a show about happiness and our human condition, then we need to talk about what is this lasting, stable happiness? Is it even a possibility? I was in the north of India once at an introduction to Buddhist meditation course, and there was this American guy there, and he said that he had gone to Australia in search of happiness because he had been lied to in America. And now he was really angry because they lied to him in Australia too, because he didn't find this happiness that he was seeking. So we're back to this whole idea of looking outside of ourselves for happiness. Is happiness really obtained by getting the job that you want? Or if you're married and you're unhappy, is the answer to happiness finding another person? It seems like we can go on and on and on looking at all the different exterior things that we're looking for happiness, and we end up in this kind of continuous loop of, okay, I'm not happy with this person, or I'm not happy in this place, or I'm not happy in this job, so I'll move to another place or get involved with another person. And when that happens and we're still not happy, then we start the search again, and there's like this continuous loop. Or sometimes people don't change their mate, or they don't change the place where they live, and then they just blame their unhappiness on the person that they're married to or the place that they live in, and they just go on about their business, kind of resigned to being unhappy because of where they are and what's going on with them. It's interesting. I saw a TV commercial once on television by some religious group, and it showed this little boy sitting on the stairs, and he was crying. And the mother comes up and she starts to yell at him, why are you crying? What are you doing? You know, that kind of thing. And then it fades away and it comes back and it shows a little boy crying again. And the mother comes up and she sits down. She starts to console him and say, oh, honey, what's wrong? What's going on? And then it flashes across the screen. Your children are what you tell them they are. This is part of what we're going to really be getting into, because it's like we're born with our DNA. We get this body, and a lot of what's going on is because of the DNA that we inherited from our parents. And so that gives us this analogy that I talked about in episode one with the hard drive and the software programs. We get our hard drive from our parents, the body and the brain, and then we start to learn things about ourselves and about the world and about others. Within the field of science, there's always an interesting debate that goes on of how much we become is from the DNA that we inherit and how much of it comes from our learning. But I don't think you can really find any science, behavioral scientists or otherwise, who will tell you, they can definitely for sure tell you, that everything you inherit determines what you will be, and that the person who is all about things being learned cannot dispute some of the findings that have been found that are from heredity. More specifically, what group you are born into really affects what software programs you learn. Of course, you will be taught by your parents about, again, who you are, what the world is, and about others. A lot of times, your parents are teaching you what their parents have taught them. And that's why you get into this thing as you get older and you go, oh my gosh, I'm just like my mother, or oh my gosh, I'm just like my father. And that's because of things that you were taught. And this starts very, very young. I was in Nepal at an outside table with a friend who had his little one-year-old son there. And the little boy was sitting on the table, and my friend said, oh, I have to go do something. Can you watch him for a minute? And I said, yes. And he laid down his phone, and he went to do whatever it was he was doing. I was playing with the little boy, and he picked up his father's phone. Now, this little boy was not walking. He was not talking. But he picked up his father's cell phone, and he started going, yeah, just making the noises like, yeah, that kind of thing. So when the man came back, I told him about this. I said, this is how much your son is watching you. He is picking up and mimicking what it is that you do, because this is how he's trying to learn about how to be in the world, unconsciously. This is just how children learn. This is why you will learn certain things, depending upon if you're male or female, more from the mother and more from the father, because this is your role model. So children not only are taught things, but they pay attention and they mimic. What they're taught or what they mimic also comes through the mind of a child, an undeveloped, immature mind of a child. Once my ex-husband told me, I was sitting there and I had sort of my hand resting on my elbow, and I was showing him this picture of my mother, and he looked at me and he said, "You do that." And it's like, "What are you talking about?" And she was sitting there like I was with her elbow on the table, and she was like moving her fingers together. And he said, "You do that." I had no idea I did that. So that's something that I picked up from watching my mother. And somehow that was significant to me of something that I should do. No memory of that. No conscious learning of that. So we have all these programs, these software programs, these learned things on our hard drive. And it doesn't matter what is inherited and what is learned. The bottom line is that these things are there, and there is a tremendous amount of things that we learn. So this is going to be a big part of what we're going to be talking about. What are the software programs that are on our hard drive that affect our happiness, that affect how we interact with others, how we perceive the world? There are many people who look at somebody of another race and they don't like them, but they never even talk to somebody from that race. So where does that come from? I had a situation when I was married. My ex-husband and I were sitting in a mall in Indianapolis, which is a huge city, and it was in the northeast side of the city and in a middle, upper middle class area, a very nice mall, and it was Christmas time and very busy, and there was people walking, you know, it was jam-packed. So we were just sitting there resting in between shopping. And this woman walked by with her little boy who couldn't have been four if he was even that. And they were white. And apparently a black man walked by them and, I don't know, touched them or accidentally, you know, it's crowded. Everybody's touching each other from here or there unintentionally. And this little boy rears back and says, "Don't touch me." And he said the N-word. I don't even want to say the word. And he screamed it at the top of his lungs. And I looked at my husband and he looked at me and it was like, OMG, oh my God, where does that come from? Think about this. You have a four-year-old boy who, first of all, knows this word. Somebody had to teach him that. You don't know this at 4 years old. What is it about, again, a four-year-old boy who would scream at an adult? The African-American person was an adult male. He screamed at the male and he screamed at him in a public setting. And the mother did absolutely nothing. So there is something learned in this child that black people are bad, and he holds them in this negative way. I found that quite appalling. In fact, I consider it child abuse if you teach your child hate. I call it abuse because are you happy when you feel hate? Does hate feel good? That's my personal view. There's a really lovely thing that's been out over the past year. You might have seen it on the internet, or I saw it probably on CNN or something like that, where there's these two little girls, a little white girl and a little black girl, and they're not in school yet, so 3 or 4 years old, and they say they're twins. I don't know if the mothers were friends, you know, the mothers were part of this conversation, but somehow these little girls knew each other. And they hugged on each other and they loved it. And they said, you know, "This is my twin, this is my twin." Well, then this news person comes along to do this interview and she's talking to the little girls and they're all happy. And she looks at them and goes, "Well, you know, you can't be twins because she's white and you're black." And the little white girl gets all indignant and she goes, "This is my sister, this is my twin." And it was interesting that the adult, of course, saw the black and white, but the children had no concept of that. And I've seen that many, many times. My nephews played with African-American children in their neighborhood. There was no concept of black and white because children are just children. There's human being and human being. You have to learn this self and other, that you are bad and I am good and that type of thing. I mean, it's interesting going to high school with very few African-Americans, but some, and I'm not aware they may have felt prejudice somewhere in this small town, well, probably a college-sized town in southern Indiana, but I never heard of it. But they could have possibly. It was interesting when they came back to a 20-year class reunion. They were kind of separate, away from everyone. And I went up and started talking to this one guy I went to high school with and his wife and made it very obvious that they were welcome. And then the guy, anyway, who graduated with us got up and was very active with the people. And I sat and talked with his wife. So it's like being out away from a town where you were accepted and people liked you. Some of the African-American kids I went to school with were basketball stars. Some weren't. But they were, again, I'm not aware of any prejudice. I know one of the black guys dated a white girl. I'm not aware of there being any trouble. There might have been. But it's just when you're out away from this and you're out in the world, the idea of prejudice is much more apparent. I worked with a young man at a hospital in Portland, Oregon, and he was of Korean heritage. He spoke to me about not finding prejudice in Portland, but when he would go outside of Portland, how he would run into that. I was surprised by that because I wasn't aware. This is my lack of knowledge, okay? I wasn't aware of the amount of prejudice that Asian people run into. He spoke about it. I have a Chinese girlfriend who spoke about it. She's actually from San Francisco. The young man I worked with at the hospital, one time we were having a problem with some kind of computer, and I said, well, let's ask him, you know? And he goes, oh, yeah, yeah, ask the Korean guy. That's a prejudice. We're supposed to know everything about computers. And I looked at him and laughed, and I said, you know, I don't have that prejudice, but I do have the prejudice of ask the young guy. So that's why I'm asking you. So we all laughed, and he got it. Because I wasn't saying it because he was Korean or Korean heritage. I was saying it because he was young and much more prolific in computers than I. So this is an ongoing thing that we have these patterns of thinking in our mind that affect how we interact with people in the world. And I challenge anyone, if you have a hatred or a dislike of anyone or anything, are you happy? Does that make you happy? So I'm talking about learned patterns of thinking as far as others. But there are all kinds of patterns that you can see. I can remember hating spinach when I was young. And the truth was is that I'd never tasted it. There's no way I would, if we had it served it at meal, I would even try it. So when I got older, at some point in time, I tasted spinach, and it is now one of my favorite foods. So I had this faulty thinking somewhere in my programs that I hated spinach, and the truth of it was I had never even tried it. So I have no idea where that came from, but that was there. Another interesting thing was that when my mother died, I was 11. So I was at the level of development where I really didn't have so much of the skills to voice how I was thinking and feeling. Whereas my older sister was 2 years older, and she was very verbal and went out and tried to get her needs met outside of herself by talking with people and getting attention. But I went inward and began to question and began to watch. So what happened was is that the night before my mother died, there were a couple girls who had gotten angry at me. We were all supposed to go to the movies, and they were angry with me and didn't want me to go. And they were in the neighborhood, and I went home crying, and my mother consoled me. And I went to bed thinking, well, I don't need them because I have my mother. Then my mother died. So this is part of the reason why I was so acutely asking the question of why do people hurt other people? And that extended not only for thinking about these girls who had been unkind to me, but thinking about people who had been unkind to my mother. And apparently, I lost about 2 weeks of time, and I had been a kind of chubby kid. And when I went back to school, I was not a chubby kid. Took me many years before I even wanted to know the dates of when my mother died because it was a trauma. She wasn't sick. There was no illness. She was there one day and gone the next, and we still don't know what she died from. The autopsy was inconclusive. So I found out that my mother had died 2 weeks before I went to school. So I was this chubby kid, and when I went back to school, I was of normal weight. So it's like, how is that possible to lose 20 pounds in 2 weeks? So when I was older, I asked my cousin, and she said, well, all you did was lie on the bed and stare at the ceiling. So no one ever talked to me about that. I'm not aware of it. Everybody was so caught up in their own suffering, and my father and my mother's mother and other extended family were very much focused on my younger brother and sister, who were like 1.5 and 3.5, and that's rightly so. Somehow, though, I just lied there on the bed, and the only thing I remember about that time period was there was a neighbor woman who came into my room to speak to me, and all I could think of was, I remember you yelling at my mother. She came to our house and yelled at my mother because my older sister had done something to her daughter. And so all I could think of was, you were unkind to my mother. Why are you here? Go away. So this was something that developed into a certain kind of patterns for me. As I grew older, I would be a kind and caring person, and, you know, everybody thought that about me, except if I thought you were messing with me. And then I would come back at you. Now, I wouldn't yell. I wouldn't scream. In fact, I was much worse than that. I was the viper. I would come back at someone with calm, cool, and collected, but stinging like a bee. My older sister used to say to me, oh, excuse me for living. And I'd look at her and smile, and I'd go, that's okay. It's not your fault. And it's like, whoa. As I got older, this started to conflict with how I wanted to be in the world, and I wanted to understand this. So I found out in my own therapy after a lot of alternative kinds of therapy for self-discovery, I discovered that when my mother died, I told myself, if you let people walk on you, you will die. Now, there is no reality in this. You die from lack of food, water, shelter in certain situations, oxygen, the number one, or if you have some kind of illness or accident, you don't die from people being unkind to you or unpleasant to you. So it was quite a realization. So we will talk about getting rid of programs that interfere with your life. And it's not necessarily an easy thing, but you cannot change something you don't know is there. So the first step is to be aware that it's there. And when it comes up, you are no longer mindlessly running on a software program. You are aware and you can choose what you do with that. So the question always comes back to, do we want to just mindlessly get up every day and reboot our programs and continue on with the thinking patterns that we have on our mind, many which are faulty and interfere with our happiness? Or do you want to pay attention? Do you want to start to take more control of how you're thinking? So the big source of all this unhappiness comes from this false cultural myth that we're all taught to look outside of ourselves to get this happiness that we want. And this is a big crux of what happens to everyone. And this affects your relationships with others, and this affects your world, and this affects your happiness, and it affects everything. Because when you look outside of yourself for your answers and for happiness, there is a certain level of helplessness that happens. And a big part of being happy is starting to feel secure in who and what you are, increasing your self-esteem. It's hard to have a stable, lasting happiness if your self-esteem is really low. And when you look outside to judge yourself, depending upon what other people think, then there's a problem. It's interesting. Different people see you differently. And if you are truly one thing that a person sees, then everyone would see you the same way. But since they don't, this is an example of how you are not what other people think or say you are. Again, if this was so, everyone would see you the same. So in the last episode, I told you that I would come back and talk about Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Maslow being a well-known psychologist, and many, many people know and have studied his pyramid of hierarchy of needs. Maslow says that the whole idea is how to reach self-actualization. And what I'm talking about is not actually the development of self per se, but the actualization of lasting stable happiness, which in many ways go hand in hand. But some of what Maslow talks about are the exterior things that I'm going to be talking to you about. But it's important to look at Maslow's work because it's hard to reach a lasting stable happiness when you have interferences with this. For example, when I was working in India, running a home for destitute and dying people, I was around a lot of really poor people. And the people that I would find in town, I got to know, and I'd ask them if they were happy, and they'd say, well, I never really thought about it. And most of them didn't seem happy because their whole thinking was on the basic needs that is where they were focused. The basic need of food, water, being warm or having shelter, and being able to rest at times. And what Maslow says is the bottom line of his pyramid on the bottom talks about what our first needs are and how you cannot move up his pyramid until these first needs are met. Even here in America, if you're homeless, usually we can get some kind of food, find some free food, hopefully. Water is free. You can get it out of some kind of fountain. Warmth can be an issue if you're homeless. And rest is debatable. Somebody's homeless and you say, I'm lying around. But the bottom line is, if you aren't warm and if you aren't comfortable, are you really able to rest? I think not. So when you move up Maslow's pyramid, the next step of his basic needs is safety needs. And that is the safety needs for security and safety. And this is what I touched on before. If you're a person of color, there is oftentimes when you don't feel safe. If a policeman stops me, again, I'm a white woman. If a policeman stops me, I'm not worried about getting shot. Many African Americans are worried if they get stopped by a policeman, often which they think is for no reason at all, that they might get shot. And since it's happened several times, there can be some basis for this thinking. So that can interfere with a level of safety. If you live on the south side of Chicago, I worked with teenagers from the south side of Chicago. And one young man, I remember, I was working in a residential treatment center for adolescents in Indianapolis when I came back from Asia one summer. And they would send the kids down from Chicago for treatment. And there was one young man, he was 13 years old, but bigger than me. He was probably close to 6 foot tall. And he was in there, and he was charged with attempted murder. So if they thought there was some kind of psych issue, they would might send him down to the psychiatric residential treatment center, which meant that you stayed there for a period of time. So this young man was from the south side of Chicago, and south side of Chicago can be rough. There are often a lot of drugs and a lot of gang activities. And so I don't remember the stability of his family, but the bottom line is that what might be attempted murder for me, a white woman who lives in comfort versus a 13-year-old boy who is faced with gangs and violence and drugs and does not live in a safe, secure environment, what would be attempted murder for him? A bottom line is very likely he was just protecting himself. And he was a lovely young man, and I would work from 7P to 7A, and he would come up in the middle of the night, and he'd act like a kid. You know, Lori, I'm hungry, you know, and it's like, oh, okay, I'm getting something to eat. And I came close with this young man. He was African-American, and he might have some difficulty with some white male staff member who's kind of under their power. But if there was a difficulty, I could walk in, and I'd say, let's make a good decision. He'd make a good decision, and the situation totally de-escalated. So this was, again, a person who was in a situation where they didn't feel safe. So it's really interesting. I'm not saying that safety is different in America than it is in, say, India, but the level of safety in America is greater than it is in India. Because I was even told when I was living and traveling in India that if you have difficulty in a situation, don't call the police. Find somebody who's Sikh, and they will usually help you. And so this is the whole idea of, yeah, you might be afraid that policemen might shoot you if you get stopped when you're, you know, if you're African-American, you get stopped when you're driving in your car. But if somebody's breaking into your house or trying to do some harm, you are going to call the police because that's a system that we have in place. And basically, you can trust the police to come and help you. And I know that's a whole big debate, but there is a system in place. And mainly, we walk our streets and we're not afraid. When I lived in Asia, I would never go out alone at night. I go out alone all the time in the West. So there are a lot of different levels of safety relevant compared to what country you live. It seems like there's a lot of violence and a lot of difficulties here in America, but it is a much safer country than it is in many other countries, especially for women. I know there's a lot of problems that women have in this country, of course, the men abusing their power and taking advantage of women. But in other countries, women actually have like zero to no rights outside of many Western cultures. So this whole idea of security and safety is dependent upon where you are, especially in India with poor people. I was in a situation once when I was running the home for destitute and dying. It was next to a Buddhist meditation center, and we were connected with this particular group. And actually, a group of robbers came late in the evening to rob the meditation center. But because we were right adjacent to them and sort of connected, they took over our home for destitute and dying people, too. And at one point, I got smacked. A long story that I won't go into. But when I was talking to some of the local women the next day, some of Mother Teresa's sisters were there working, and they came to see me. And these were Indian women, and they told me that this happens in the villages every night. So you have these far-out villages where there's no protection. All you have is the people in the village, but you have people coming with guns, and who in the village is going to be able to fight them off? So people get mugged and robbed all the time. So this is not something that we fear in this country. So when I ask them if they're happy, of course, everybody wants to be happy. But it's just that they don't have time to think about it because they're worried about the food, they're worried about the water, they're worried about warmth and shelter and security and safety. So as you move up Maslow's pyramid, the next step is belongingness and love needs. So intimate relationships and friends. This is what he says you need to move on up his pyramid. These are psychological needs, these next two steps, the one I just mentioned, and the next one, which is esteem needs. And these are for prestige and feeling of accomplishment. And this is the level of self-esteem that I talked about. until you get a certain level of feeling good about yourself, a certain level of self-esteem, you will not move up to the next step, the final step, which is self-actualization, the actualization of a stable, lasting happiness. And this is our goal. So we will talk about these things. And I will refer back to Maslow because, after all, he is a well-known person that I studied and many people study, and I think is an excellent resource for what it is that I'm talking about. So when he talks about self-actualization, he's talking about or describes it as achieving one's full potential, including creative activities. I will be focusing on achieving this lasting, stable happiness. So as we go on, I will be referring to Maslow and his needs and our needs, actually, and how this interacts with the thinking processes that we have as we start to look at what it is that we have learned and that we have going on in our life that interferes with our happiness and our lives when it comes to others and everything. So as I talked about in the last episode, I'll be ending the episodes with a short conversation about the power of kindness, because that is something that we can do right now, at any time, in any place, is to show kindness to someone. And the incredible power of showing kindness to someone and the incredible power that it has on increasing our own happiness. It's interesting because the Dalai Lama calls this wise selfishness. Even if you're being kind to someone else because you want to increase your own happiness, because it helps them, it's like a wise selfishness. I think that's lovely. I love that he says that. There's actually a 17th century Catholic saint called Saint Francis de Sales who said, "Nothing is so strong as gentleness, and nothing is so gentle as real strength." And that's how I feel about kindness. Kindness is very, very powerful. Think about it. Who do you want to be around? The person that's kind to you or the person who you have to be afraid of? Who do you remember most? Yeah, you might remember the bully or the unkind person, but the person that you remember very strongly and you want to remember is the person who was kind to you. I was back one summer and I was working in a psychiatric facility and I was working for a nursing registry and I would go there and work whenever they needed an extra nurse. So I wasn't on this particular unit all the time. I would just go sometimes. And there was a particular patient there. It was a male and female unit. And when you were assigned to work with her, you had to watch her closely because she would get into some unhealthy behavior. So one day I was assigned to work with her and I looked out onto the lounge area and she wasn't there. So I knew she was probably on the outside screened-in porch. So I went out there and she was sitting on the cold floor. This was a woman who really couldn't converse. You weren't able to have a conversation with and talk to. She was very turned inward and having a lot of difficulty. So I helped her up off the floor. I set her in a chair, and then I sat down on the arm of the chair. And the woman, what she did was she leaned her head over and rested it on my leg. And I started to pat her on the back. And I was out there for a period of time with her, enough time that one of my coworkers came out to check on me and be sure it was okay. Now, technically, you weren't supposed to make physical contact with patients, but this woman was suffering so much, I didn't care. It was a simple thing of she laid her head on my leg and I patted her. So I don't remember how the rest of the day went, but I wasn't there for a few days. And as I started to come back and I would see her, she seemed to be getting better and better. And I checked her medication. I didn't see any change with the medication. And as she improved and got to the point where she would have conversations, I said to her one day, I said, "Wow, you know, you're so much better. What happened? I know they haven't changed your medicine." And she looked at me, she said, "Do you remember the day when you set me in the chair and I laid my head on your leg and you patted me?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And she said, "I just needed someone to show me kindness. That's all. I just needed someone to show me kindness." And she continued to progress and moved on out of the hospital. And I thought, wow, just a simple thing, just a simple act of patting someone who was suffering had this incredibly powerful thing. So I have seen many, many times the power of kindness, and I think that many of us know the power of kindness in our own lives. So if you're feeling down or you just want to feel better, you want to feel more happy, then experience going out and showing kindness. Stop and let the person cross the street. Say hello to somebody you don't know crossing on the street. Whatever it is, just do some simple act of kindness and see how that feels. And that is something that you can do right now as we have these conversations. So we will continue on in the next episode to talk more and more about the patterns, the software programs we learned culturally and in our families, and what to think and do about those. And then at some point in time, we will talk more and more about this other cultural thing about feeling that we're alone in our human condition, because this one is a really powerful one that also affects our self-esteem. So if our goal is a lasting, stable happiness, then we're going to have this conversation. So I'm ML Laurie. I hope you'll stop and think about all of this, and I hope you'll be kind to yourself. And join me in my next episode, along with emailing me at mllaurie@kboo.org with your questions and comments.